Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Joining me is the guy who introduced us or introduced me to Daryl Horn. And I met Ray Limbaugh a month or so ago, maybe 6 weeks ago. And I told him what I was doing. And he said, you know, you really do need to talk to somebody I know that's written a book. And he's in Bravo Company. And so I don't know that I think the story of Operation Buffalo certainly starts with Bravo Company. And so for the last 3 weeks, you've heard Daryl Horn. And so now you're going to meet Ray Limbaugh. And Ray is an Alpha Company 1-9 Marine and joins us from his home in Colorado. Where in Colorado, Ray?
It's Canyon City. It's where the Royal Gorge is in the Arkansas River. It's just west, due west of Pueblo. In the southern part.
Due west of Pueblo. So yeah, I've never been there.
It's a mountain area. It's really beautiful here.
So as I told you before we can decide if we can believe anything you have to say as Marines, we got to sniff. You got to pass the sniff test. So let's talk about you before we talk about Vietnam. First of all, born and raised where?
I was raised in Springfield, Missouri, in Branson area, and finished high school there and graduated in 1965.
So you
should have been 66, but I had to take third grade twice. I was hyperactive.
Truth be told, third grade's pretty difficult. It's a well-kept secret. It's a well-kept secret among educators, but third grade is pretty rough. But you know what? They don't do that to kids anymore.
No, that's one reason I became a grunt is because of that too.
they just pass them on. Like, yeah, you're not very good, yeah. But we don't care. We're not keeping you around for another year. Get the hell out of here.
Yeah, that's true. Back then they were a little stricter.
Yeah, a little bit. And they'd even tell you that you flunked, too. They had no qualms about that kind of crap. So you're born and raised in Springfield. You didn't sound like you had a Colorado accent. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, we had a Marine recruiter come to our high school. And I was very impressed, and I knew because of my grades, that wasn't much better than the third grade, that I was going to get drafted and I was going to be a grunt. So I thought, I want to know what that guy knows. So as soon as I got out of high school, I went to the Marine recruiter and said, do you have a 2-year program? They go, no, 4 years. So I said, well, I think I'll look around. Well, it was like 2 days later, I got drafted. And so the recruiter called me and said, hey, we've got a buddy program. You get some guy to come in here and we'll give you 2 years. And I said, I got drafted. I'm in the Army. He goes, no. You joined last week, remember? And he backdated all the paperwork and I became a Marine.
So you didn't, you had nobody in your family that was a Marine? You didn't grow up with somebody talking about the Marines? You just saw a recruiter, God bless those guys and girls, in their uniform and said, I got to have some of that?
Yeah, I knew I needed the discipline, and I just inherently knew that I was going to be a grunt. And the only other pulling my life in that direction was John Wayne. He was like part of my family in a way. And
explain that. Explain how John Wayne becomes part of your family.
Because of back then, we would, the only thing, we didn't have a lot of the TV, but we had the movies.
Right.
And I saw the Iwo Jima movie with John Wayne and the patriotism that it was, you know, back then patriotism was big.
Right.
And so John Wayne played a big part of me wanting to be a real man. And I didn't have any, I can't think of anybody in my family that was in the military. Maybe back in the Civil War or something like that, but everybody else was either too old or too young back in World War II.
And so,
my dad was blind in one eye, so he couldn't do that. So,
you off to San Diego, you go?
Yeah, I went to Kansas City for my induction and physical and all that. And while I was there, they came out and they said, okay, everybody, you all passed your physicals. Everybody on this side, go in that door, you're in the Army. Everybody on this side, go in that door, you're in the Marines. Half the guys that I was in boot camp with were drafted Marines. We were losing like 500 a week or something.
Right.
And they had to get us. And my San Diego, it was full. We had Tent City all the way in that field that goes all the way back to the Navy boot camp.
Right.
That whole field was full of tents. And our boot camp was cut 2 weeks short just to get us over there.
All right, so then it comes time to get MOSs, and were you surprised when they told you you were going to be a grunt? Did you expect it? You knew why they were drafting people. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of things that were more prominent in the news back then than Vietnam.
Well, they did pass out of papers, and it had different jobs and different MOSs on it. And I went down the line and I marked small arms grunt. I wanted to be a grunt.
Motivated. There you go. And it got your ass sent to Contien. Good for you. What about so? Now you relieve recruit training. And
yep.
And what, you guys went up to Camp Pendleton after that, right?
Yeah, we did they called it ITR, infantry training, and I did that at Camp Horno in the San Clemente end of Pendleton.
Yeah.
And we trained there, and We weren't there that, didn't seem like we were there that long, but we trained with the M14s. And I never heard, not once, about an M16. Had no clue. So I qualified on the range with an M14. And so it was time to go. And at that point, this was April of 67, and we stopped for gas in Hawaii. We weren't allowed to get out of the airport, but we went over on a Continental airline. We even had stewardess.
Yeah.
And so, well, they quit doing that because a little while later, Da Nang started getting hit, and some of them commercial airlines started taking flak, and there was some stewardess that got hurt, so they quit doing that. They started flying. We went to Okinawa first and stored our sea bags, and then we went Westpac. We went to Vietnam from Okinawa, and my feeling at the time, I was so proud to be a Marine and to graduate. And I was a house mouse, so because I'm short, so that wasn't fun at all. But
okay, hold on. Explain to everybody. Hold on one second. Some people might not be familiar that are going to listen to this that don't understand what a house mouse is. Tell everybody what a house mouse is.
A house mouse in boot camp, there's two, and they usually pick the two short guys. And they, when they say house mouse up, you have to go in and you make the drill instructor's bed, you shine his shoes, you straighten up his bunks and all that. And we're like their little servants. So that was not good. And the other guy got fired. And they beat the hell out of him. So I thought, well, I'm just going to be a good house mouse. So I stayed. And drill instructor beat me up one time because he was mad at his wife. So that just made my resolve, because that's the first time I wanted to kill somebody. So that really helped me out a little bit in Vietnam.
That hate?
I had that killing instinct by then.
because he had beat you. Now the Marine Corps doesn't do that anymore. I mean, there's house mouses, but they don't do servants kind of stuff anymore. At least they're not supposed to. But there's still the term, and there's still people that perform certain administrative functions around the platoon and series and things like that. Interesting. Hey, just so I know, you in talking about the M14, did you grow up? You grew up in Missouri. Did you grow up hunting and shooting?
Oh yeah, yeah. That's another plus. When I was a kid, we hunted, so we were crack shots. And I've served with a lot of boys from Texas, and them boys were good shots too. So we were all in boot camp. Everybody was a good shot. But the difference between nowadays and then is we grew up, you're outside all the time. Your parents don't know where the heck you are. Mm-hmm. And we played in the streams, and we did, when it flash flooded in Springfield, we'd jump in there with logs and float them little streams down, and we would go in caves a lot. And we were tough kids.
Right.
So, and at night, we did all kinds of night games and things. So in Vietnam, I loved it at night. I mean, I wasn't afraid. The night, I made me invisible. And those kids, we were only 19, 20 years old. But man, and 18 years old, but we were tough. We grew up that way. Our gym teacher would beat the hell out of you if you didn't straighten up. You know, I mean, it was different back then. The discipline was, and taking command when you had to take command and you were a PFC and you had to take command or something, we could do it. I mean, we just had that discipline in us. So
different, Ray. Can you imagine if you were a kid, if this stay-at-home order would have been given when you were a kid, would you have stayed at home?
Oh, no. We'd be out the window. Right. We never stayed in. At night, we would crawl out the window and take Dad's car keys and push the car out of the driveway and push it down the street. And then start it up and take off.
I told my daughters that the other day. We were talking. I said, let me just tell you. Do you think I would, if I was a kid now, do you think I would sit at home all day with my mom? No way. I'd meet my friends, and we'd go hop a fence, and we'd go play baseball. And then one of my daughters said, well, what about if the cops came? I said, we'd hop another fence and run away and wait till they left and then start playing again. We would not. Yeah, we would no more sit home with our mothers all day. They looked at me like, no. "Oh, really?" And I said, "No, we just didn't do that. We weren't raised indoors. Most of our moms were home. So you went home, you changed your clothes from school, and then you got on your bike and you left, and you went looking for fun and adventure. We played sports." Right. We did not. And they're like, all right, whatever. I'm just telling you.
Right.
They're like, so if you were like all told to stay at home, I'm like, we would not have done it. We would have been in creeks and just having a good time.
Yep. Yep. That's exactly right.
So,
and that worked in our, that worked in Vietnam. That was, well, when I got there.
Well, let me ask you another question. You mentioned about toughness. You know, I mean, and part of that as a kid, when you get on your bike and you go roaming around your neighborhood, somebody else's neighborhood, you know, on a daily basis, there's a chance that somebody's going to get in a fight. And if one of your friends gets in a fight, you're expected to help if you have to. And so, you know, that was not unusual growing up, right? It was not a big deal. And so, you know, now, I mean, for a kid to get in a fight, you get thrown out of school and everything like that. You know, it was made you a tough, self-reliant kid.
Well, we, in the eighth grade, we had a fight club. And there was the Tracy brothers and Larry Hodges and a bunch of, we'd divide up. And we would say, okay, when we meet each other somewhere between classes or recess or whatever, we fight. And they say, okay. And, man, we would fight like beating each other up. And then we would talk about, and the bell would ring and we'd take off, get to our classes. But we were never mad at each other. And in high school, they had fight clubs where the guys would go out and go in the park. And they would fist the older guys, like seniors, and they would fist fight and carry on. And afterwards, they would put their arms around each other and talk about how what a good match that was, or they would critique their fighting skills. So we grew up, but we never really got mad. My dad always told me, if you're in a fight, never get mad. The madder you get, the worse you'll get licked. And that's true, you know. But yeah, we would fight, but
now, hey,
we
now,
didn't hold it against each other.
Now dads tell their kids not to fight. Don't fight.
Oh man, that's part of growing up.
It is. I think it's a huge part of confidence for boys. And so, I mean, my dad told me that never throw the first punch in a fight. And then I figure out by the time I'm like 12, the most important punch in a fight is the first punch. Right? So I tell my kids, okay, if you're going to get in a fight, you decide that this guy wants to fight, you throw the first 10 punches in the fight. That's the rule. And they looked at me. Their little guys are like, what? You don't. And look, I'll come to you. Look, if you get the principal's, you're in his office, I'll come, and then we'll go to Disneyland. We'll go wherever you want to go. Don't lose your fights. Okay? Don't lose your fights. So throw the first 10 punches. And that's the truth, too. That's the God's truth. You can ask my sons. I'd tell them that. And the first punch goes straight to the throat, okay? Because that'll make their eyes tear up, right? And they'll grab their throat. Then you grab them by the hair, and you could do all kinds of, like, Bugs Bunny tricks and shit like that. You know, you could do all – and then you could have a good time, right? But if you think they want to fight you, first punch to the throat, grab them by the hair, and then start playing reindeer games with them. Oh, my God. Yeah, my dad raised me to be like a 10-year-old counterpuncher, right? Right? And I was never quick enough to do it. And then I figured out, man, I'm not doing that anymore. I keep getting hit. You throw the first punch. You throw the first punch. Okay. Boom. Oh, that's funny. So we'll go. So now you get to Okinawa, right? You stage for Vietnam in Okinawa. And then at some point, you fly over to Da Nang, and they receive you with is the first division at Da Nang, or
third division?
Was it Dong Ha?
Yeah, we were replacements.
Right.
The 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, went over as a unit, and they just kept getting replacements. So when I got there, they took me. I went from Da Nang up to Phu Bai, and then I went into a tent, and the guy said, "Oh, we're glad to see you." I said, "Where am I going?" He goes, 1-9. I said, "Oh, okay. Where's that?" And he goes, "North." And I said, "Well, how do I get there? And they said, any way you can. So I think I got a ride on a 6x going up Highway 1. But anyway, I reported in up there, and I said, well, what kind of outfit is this? And they said, well, don't get to know people too well. I said, oh, really? And it was April, and I remember we were our first operation. We were going to walk all night to get to Charlie Company, who was already in place, and they gave us these M16s. And I said, "What the hell is this?"
Now, Ray, so when you got there, you got assigned to Bravo Company, Alpha Company, right away.
Right away.
Right away. Yeah. And so, right away, but and so 1-9 in now what month is this? May, June,
April.
Oh, this is April of 1967. So and already 1-9 had a reputation that yeah, you don't want to go there.
Oh well, I they didn't really say that. I just knew. I didn't know what I was walking into.
Okay.
They just got done with an operation called Fu'an, and all they could talk about was Fu'an this and Fu'an that and Fu'an and how bad it was. And just before that, we had one of our Medal of Honor winners, Singleton, Sergeant Singleton, and they were talking about him. And they were talking about a guy that wrote Hell is a Very Small Place, Bernard Fall, was with our outfit. He was with 2nd Platoon. He was with my squad before I got there, and he stepped on a Boulton Betty, and that was the end of him. And they were talking about him, and he was some French author. That's all they didn't know anything about. You know, writings or anything. I found out years later who he was, but they were talking about all this, and man, they were scaring the heck out of me. I said, man, is it that bad? And they go, oh, yeah. I mean, it gets worse. And I said, how could it get worse? And they said, well, just hang around for a while. And that's when they gave us the M16s, and they take us out back where the dump was. And they
now hold on. Did you like the M14?
I love the M14. Yeah. I could shoot the, you know, you look at it, I could shoot it, but it was a heavy gun,
right?
And you couldn't carry that much ammo, so the M16 had small magazines. It was light. I mean, that thing was weighed less than 6 pounds, I think, and. I took it out and we shot it and we didn't know how to take care of them. We didn't know whatever. And the first operation, Charlie Company got hit before we got there. And they lost 20 guys because them damn things jammed, and they were fighting them off with K-bars and entrenching tools. And they're making, yeah, anyway, that's a whole different story. But yeah, the powder was too gunked up. It fired so fast that the spring in the butt had a buffer that was made of aluminum. And so it would fire so fast, it'd go up to the ejector, would grab the case and pull the lip off of it. And then you'd have to take your cleaning rod, shove it down the barrel, knock the spent round out of it. And you're in a firefight and you look down the line, it looked like the Alamo. It looked like got musket loaders. I mean, guys were shoving those rods down. And if you didn't have a rod, you had to borrow the guy next to you's rod to knock out the spent round. And so that's where the boys learn hand-to-hand, because them things – and you hit somebody over the head with one of them M16s and they shatter, you know, I mean, it was terrible.
Right.
So they fixed them and they made us only carry 18 rounds in a magazine because the spring, you had to wake it up by slamming it on your helmet just before you put it in.
Right.
And they put a weighted buffer in that spring, slowed the rate of fire down and gave us better ammunition that was smokeless. And that seemed my second M16, it didn't jam on me that much.
All right. I just looked up. It says the M14 with magazine was 10 pounds, 1 ounce. And then I looked up the M16. Now, how many rounds in an M14 magazine? 10?
Oh, well, I'm not sure. I can't remember how many rounds.
It says
they only gave us 3 to qualify.
The M16 with a 30-round magazine is 8 pounds, 13 ounces.
Well, we never got that. The first ones were 20 rounds. 20 round
right,
clips,
right.
Magazines, and then they only because the spring would compress so that sometimes it wouldn't pop the round up. So they told us just put 18, but we would tape the magazines upside down back to back. So all we have to do is pull it out and turn it upside down and go again. So some guys did that. But if you see the guys take the magazine and slam it on their helmet,
mm-hmm.
That was to wake the spring up.
Right.
You know.
Right. No, for people, if you look at pictures of the fighting around Leatherneck Square, and you're kind of a picture weirdo like I am, and you really scrutinize the pictures, you won't have to look very far to see a Marine with a cleaning rod out during a fight. And that's what, and that's what Ray's talking about right here. And, and it was the problem when the M16 was fielded and how irritated people were, even though that it weighed more, it just did not function when it was originally issued, which has colored the fielding of every rifle since then, you know, and you always hear, hey, this thing better work because we're not going to do what we did with the M16. And of all this, of stupid on top of stupid, we did that, you know, to Marines and soldiers that were fighting. And Ray's talking about, you know, you had to be ready to fight hand to hand or with e-tools or whatever you could do because your rifle, you know, didn't work. And guys died because of it. So not a very pleasant episode. Talk about, so you get there in April. One of the things that's very different than the way we go to war today. We go to war as units today. So your whole unit rotates in. You rotated as an individual. I've read stories and that your first time out in the bush, so to speak, you know, they looked at you. You were an FNG, right? A fucking new guy. And they said, let's go get up there. You're walking point today. Other guys said, I got treated better. You know, I was on a couple of patrols before they told me, all right, it's your turn now. You've seen enough. Time to take your turn. How did you get received and treated, Ray?
I got received pretty good. I had a squad leader. His name was Michael Jones. And I swear this guy looked like Cliff Robertson, the movie star.
Right.
And this guy took me under his wing, and he taught me everything. He saved my life. He taught me everything, and he treated us. He treated everybody equally, but we didn't put the new guys on point. And when I was a squad leader, I didn't put new guys on point. I usually put the good guys, the skilled guys, I didn't mind walking point because I knew I could read the sign for booby traps, and I could sense, you could smell them. They could smell us, but you could smell them. You could sense in the jungle, you could sense that there was a problem, but you put a new guy up there and he's going to step on a bouncing Betty, which happened, or he's going to be, they didn't shoot the first guy.
Right.
So the point guy was not usually that big of a target at first. because the new guy, they wanted him to walk into a booby trap or something. And if you put an unskilled guy up there, that's what's going to happen. And then you're screwed, because that's when the fire, when the bullets start flying, somebody's down. That's just automatic. So you don't put the new guys on point. And that's my squad leader, Mike Jones. He got killed, by the way, but he taught us, and he walked point a lot of times, and he taught us to your men come first. And so I was very, very fortunate to have a good squad leader. And yeah, they treated me with respect. I treated other guys with respect too.
So let's talk about, you join Alpha Company. What's the first operation you go out on?
Well, that was the, it was called, I got one of those mental blocks. Bighorn. It was called Bighorn. And I thought, and I remember looking at it, I said, who the hell names these things? That didn't go well for Custer. Right. And I said, I don't know, but I don't like that either. But it was Bighorn. And that's the one where we went out. Charlie Company was close to this, outside this ville. And the Captain Reed decided to do a night assault. And we walked all night long in the very black, dark. I mean, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. You had to hold on to the guy in front of you. And it was a whole company. And we had to go over rice paddies, and there was shoot cussing. There was a whisper cussing all the way, because you'd lose contact with the guy or you'd fall off the dike. And then we had the M16s. It was very confusing. And if you ever, I've never been blind before. So that was it was a horrifying not to be able to see. And I asked Slater one time, I said, how in the hell did you were going? And it was dark. He goes, well, I just had a artillery illumination shoot every now and then in the direction I'm supposed to go. And then I'd take my compass and I'd guide off of that. I can't believe you did that.
For people that have never done it, moving at night's hard, because, you know, you're trying to keep track of the guy in front of you, you're trying to look around. Depending on the vegetation, you're getting smacked in the face by branches and stuff, and guys are getting pissed, and you're trying to be quiet. I mean, it's a no-shit challenge moving through vegetation at night, and especially when in this case, you don't know the area, right? You're trying to come from someplace that he doesn't expect you, and it's much easier said than done.
Well, it was the longest night of my life. I thought we'd never stop. And you could not see the guy in front of you. So that when they got hit, it was the next night, we heard it on the radio, and they shot the radio. So we thought that the radio guy was dead, but he wasn't. And a Charlie Company came out and found us, and we followed the tracks of this. Antos. They call it an Antos. It was half track and
The thing.
Wheels. Yeah. And we got there, and that's Charlie Company. That's when Reed, who was an idiot, he should not have done that. And the NCOs, the staffs and everything, were telling him, we do not do night assaults. The Marine Corps doesn't do that. And he said, well, we're going to be the first. Well, when the illumination went off, the gooks were standing right in front of him, and he was the first one to get killed. So that was a really bad night, but we got there. And one of my good friends now, he, after 52 years, Jim Strogner, he just got a Navy Cross for that particular night. And wow. He was in Charlie Company, and he had to kill him, fight him off with a K-bar. He was laying down. He was a machine gun's assistant. He was laying down, and when the illumination went off, NVA soldier with an AK-47 was standing only about 15 feet from him, and he went to raise up, and he shot and hit that M16 twice, and right in the magazine, and it saved his life. But his rifle was dead, so that night he had to use his K-bar a lot, and he ended up getting a Navy Cross for that. So that was my first time. It wasn't fun at all.
Did you remember? And again, what's important about these interviews, Ray, is that, you know, there's so much discussion about, you know, fighting the Chinese or the Russians or fighting a peer. And I believe the last time we really did that was up in the vicinity of Leatherneck Square when you guys took on the North Vietnamese Army. They were, you know, they were committed to coming and fighting the Marines. And they right. And talk to me about, you know, you and I were talking a little bit earlier that, you know, the name for the Vietnamese was Charlie. In the movie Apocalypse Now, there's a famous saying, right? Charlie doesn't serve. And you said you guys had a different name for Charlie.
Yeah, we called him Gooks. We called him Charlie. But after a while, I remember this black guy turned around and said, no. He'd been there for a while. He said, we call him Mr. Charles. Mr. Charles, not Charlie, Mr. Charles.
And that was,
I'll never forget that.
That was a sign of respect.
It was I mean, we did. We respected. But see, we were outgunned. The AK-47s did not jam. We were outgunned. We were outgunned. They used artillery on us in July the 2nd during Operation Buffalo's. They had artillery spotters out there because I ran into one, and they were using artillery, and we were outgunned with artillery, with everything, because they were getting supplied with Russian and Chinese. And speaking of Chinese, we killed a lot of Chinese. I personally killed two Chinese in a bunker. This was another operation, but the night of the 6th of July, we killed a big, this guy looked like Odd Job. He was big, and you said, that was no gook, man, that's Chinese. So, you know, and they were mercenaries. They come down, but you could always tell the Chinese, because they were stocky, and some of them were tall.
Interesting, because a lot of people don't know that.
A lot of people don't know that, but we killed the heck out of Chinese.
So let's see. We've got we're going to do this in two segments, so everybody knows. There's essentially two fights that we're going to talk about, and the first fight we're going to talk about. If you look, go to the Contien maps that are included in the post. You'll see kind of a general orientation to Leatherneck Square, and you'll see where Contien is. And the third image down is you'll see the Contien firebase superimposed on a Google Earth image, and kind of going right down the center, you'll see at the bottom where Bravo Company 9th Marines. Spends the night, and then if you go to the left, just north of the firebase, you'll see where Alpha Company spent the night on July 1st, and then you'll see when the ambush got essentially sprung on Bravo Company. You see where 3rd Platoon was and 2nd Platoon were on the 2nd of July, and we use those maps where the marketplace was,
And then further to the west, you see where Alpha Company was when they ran into it. So I want to talk about Operation Buffalo. You had been there for a couple months at this point, and you guys had been in Contien, and you were going right back into the area that Charlie and Delta Company had just been up working in. And I've been told that that wasn't typical, that normally in the, you guys worked the area of operation in kind of a checkerboard fashion, that if they went there, the next two companies that would go out when they came back went someplace else. And a lot of guys had the sense of if we go straight back in there, you know, we're going to catch it. We're going to run into them big time. Did you have that sense going out there for Buffalo, Ray, or was it just another op that you guys were going out and looking for the NVA and try to kill them?
Well, we'd been in battle after battle after operation after. By now, I'm seasoned. You know, I was a lance corporal, but I was an assistant squad leader, and I was a squad leader for a while, and because I was a lance corporal, when we got a guy that was able to be a corporal, then he would take over the squad. So on that particular situation, we just knew that it was bad going out there. But see, the enemy knew that we would do a sweep like Charlie Company did, and then we wouldn't do it for a certain period of time. But Colonel Schenning, our battalion commander, sent us out there, but the major Fulham, he was a major, but he was our battalion commander, and he'd been over there like 16 months or something, and he told Schenning, "Now, I'm leaving, but do not send anything out there less than a battalion, because they are massing. Something is coming, you know." And we were security for that strip. We cleared the jungle. It's called the buffer, or it's called the trace, whatever. And we cleared the jungle. We were security for that.
McNamara's line, right? All that stuff.
It's called the McNamara line.
Right.
It went from Contien to Joy Lynn. And it was a strip of jungle that was, you know, leveled so that we could stop them from coming across or whatever. So we could see them.
Right.
So we knew that this was not a good thing. We knew that this was going to be tough. And so Bravo Company was already out there. They were about 1,500 meters, you know, east. And we knew it was going to be bad because the night before, on the 30th, the night before, in June 30th, my squad was supposed to go out for NIDAC, and it was really dark that night. And we didn't get outside our perimeter 20, 30 feet, you know. Now, I didn't get out because I was kind of back a little ways. And our point man ran into a gook, an NVA, bumped right into him. And he backed off in the NVA. He backed off and took off, and our guy backed up. And so they whispered down the line, "Hey, we're running into gooks out here." And so the skipper said, "Just sit down right where you're at." So the whole squad out just outside the perimeter, we just sat down, and we stayed there all night until morning. We got up, and you could smell them. They stunk. And we knew that something, I said, you know, we're in trouble here. And so that morning, all of a sudden we heard fire and we heard mortars, and we knew Bravo was getting hit. And so the order came down, get the Bravo company. They're under attack big time. And
now you guys you're both north of Contien. They're headed up that route 571, I think it is, if I'm not mistaken,
right.
and headed towards the marketplace where they get ambushed by multiple battalions, and you're about 1,500 meters west of them, heading north as well.
Right. That's correct. Well, they were a little – yeah, we were north of them, a little north of them. And so we took off, and our point man, and he was a new guy. I think he was a new guy. He stepped on a bouncing Betty. Well, what they did is they knew they got in between Bravo Company and Alpha Company, and they set up booby traps. And then they had some most of them were attacking. They swept through Bravo Company like it was terrible. And so we took off. We had that casualty to deal with. And so Slater, and we started getting some wounded guys. And so Slater said, 3rd Platoon, make a perimeter, and we're going to bring wounded into you, and we're going to call in medevac choppers, and 3rd Platoon is going to be protect the wounded and secure for helicopters coming in for medevac.
Yeah, just so everybody knows, Slater is Captain Slater, right?
Captain Slater,
right.
Captain Contact, we call him. That was his nickname. So he sent Staff Sergeant Leslie, 1st Platoon leader, around south and east, no, north and east to try to get around to flank and get to Bravo Company. And 2nd Platoon went straight east, right down the middle, to try to get to Bravo Company. Well, on our way there, they broke off and they came at us. And we heard 3rd Platoon was getting overrun. They had circled around that outfit that we ran into that night. They stayed and they hit 3rd Platoon. And we had a new lieutenant, Mueller. He shouldn't have been there. And he had everybody facing the wrong damn way. And they overran 3rd Platoon. So we had to go back. And when we went back, all of a sudden they were everywhere. They came up and it was raining mortars. And so I was in it was a ditch. With the radio man and with a black kid, his name is Horace, and Steve, a corpsman. And what they did is they would take the flak jackets, helmets, and M16s off of the wounded or killed Marines and put them on, and then they made a beeline at us wearing Marine outfits. And they tricked tricked Bravo. I talked to a bunch of Bravo Company guys. And they said a bunch of them were dressed in Marine uniforms, and they thought it was Alpha Company. And one of the guys, Larry Pratt, he was waving at this guy, and the guy shot him right in the leg. And he fell down. He took a grenade and threw it out and killed the guy in the Marine outfit. But when they came and attacked us, 60 feet in front of me, was a gook wearing a Marine uniform. And I knew it was a gook. I said, that's a freaking gook, man. I said, get on up. I had my radio, man. I said, find out where if Charlie Company's anywhere in the area. Because, you know, he might be a Mexican. I don't know. He's foreign. He's not. Right. But I could not shoot that uniform. And he waved at me, and I waved at him. And all of a sudden, an NVA pith helmet and an AK-47 come walking out, didn't know that me and this guy were talking, so to speak. And he looked at me and I looked at him and I waved and I shot both of them. To this day, that sticks in my mind. The hardest thing I ever did was to shoot that Marine uniform, knowing that's a friggin' gook. But shooting it and watching him fall with that uniform on was the hardest thing I ever did to this day.
Because of the uncertainty, not 100%, but pretty sure that you know that that's not a Marine.
Even though I knew it was a gook,
right?
The hardest thing was to shoot that. He had an M16. He had a helmet on. It was Bravo's, one of Bravo Company's men's helmet and flak jacket. So they rained mortar. They turned their attack, and the Bravo Company, some guys, survivors, told me, they said, Ray, if Alpha Company hadn't got, because we felt bad because we didn't get there.
Right.
We never got there. But they said they broke their attack off and came at us. And that saved them from being a lost company. And so those mortars were hitting so close to my hole that Horace decides to, you know, he was new. And he decided it was too close and he was going to run. I grabbed him and I pulled him in that. I said, stay in the hole. And he, about the third or fourth really close one, he bolted and he ran. And when he did, a mortar got him. Now, the corpsman was new. His name was Stephen Minchek. Stephen Minchek started to run out of the hole and I grabbed him and I pulled him back and I said, don't leave the hole. He goes, there's a wounded man. I said, you can't help him. You can't do anything. Stay in the hole. And when I was on the radio trying to find out where Charlie Company was, Steve bolted and went out there and was bent over Horace, and a round came in and killed him. And that just broke my heart. But he was one of eight. We lost eight corpsmen in one day. On July the 6th, we lost eight corpsmen killed.
Okay, we're still on July 2nd, right?
This is July 2nd.
Okay.
Trying to get the Bravo.
Okay, all right. So you're hearing the firing off to the east, and really 2nd and 3rd platoon is killed. And what was interesting talking to Daryl is that everybody who had a radio was killed, and then the entire command group had either an arty round or a mortar round hit and killed all of them. So the battalion CP back at Contien, which is only, you know, maybe 2 kilometers from where this is going on, they can hear it, but nobody knows what's going on.
They knew.
Well, they knew they were shooting, but they weren't, other than the initial contact report, the radios went dead and they were getting They were getting no reports from Bravo Company.
Well, they were getting them from us.
Right, right.
Yeah, right. And there was 2 captains killed. There was a Captain Coates, who was the company commander, and Kepter, it's a funny name, but he was the air controller. He was a pilot.
Right.
Anyway... He was killed with, and the last transmission from Coates was, I don't think you'll hear from us again, or something like that. And sure enough, Gunny Burns is a good friend of mine, and he was one of the survivors, and he told me a lot about all that.
Just so everybody knows, to relate it to Daryl's horn story about Bravo Company, Gunny Burns at the time he's a platoon commander for 1st Platoon, which is down at the Trace, and he winds up, you know, essentially taking over the company, and they had 65 guys killed, 55 wounded, and the 26, 27 that stay, they're all wounded too, and it's Gunny right. Burns who lashes that whole thing up. And whatnot. So and he's the recipient of a Navy Cross for his actions that day. And so as you guys move to the east and the NVA, so what's going on with Bravo Company is they're decimated very, very quickly. between, you know, the estimates when you read about the attack are 3 to 4 battalions, you know, 2,000 plus NVA soldiers in this wide crescent, and Bravo Company walks into it, and they're essentially decimated. You guys, as you move, try to fight to get to the east, take pressure off them, and make the NVA reorient towards you. How long does that fight go on all day, Ray?
Well, here's what happened. When 3rd Platoon got overrun, Slater had to rescue his guys.
Right.
And so we weren't that far from 3rd Platoon. So we turned and went back. Well, when we went back, they hit us with everything. Well, now 3rd Platoon is scattered. Guys are scattered all over the place. So we made a small perimeter inside a hedgerow. It was an old dried up rice paddy, and it was surrounded by big, thick hedgerows. And so we made a circle, and we had a radio. I mean, he was with the radio man, and we held that position. It was our last stand, and Slater said, fix bayonets, get ready to defend yourselves. This is it. And what we did, we knew we were close to the guys in 3rd Platoon, and they were in little circles and little clusters, and there was wounded all spread out all over the place. So what we did is we would take turns going out and grabbing Marines and pulling them into our perimeter. And the snipers were shooting at us, but this is really a God thing because not one of those snipers hit any of us. I mean, they were shooting, but they were lousy shots that day. But anyway, the snipers were getting ready, holding off because the remnant, I mean, a bunch of the NVA were coming to our position to try to wipe us out now. So we would run out and grab people and pull them in. And one of the guys was Lieutenant Mueller. I grabbed him and brought him in, and he had a leg wound. But he was dead. He died of – his face was like he died of fright. His heart gave out on him because he didn't have a life-threatening wound. It made me so mad I just slapped him. And because he told me a story, he shouldn't have been there anyway. But one guy, the best part of that day, so we ran out, and there was this big, long, tall, black guy named Raglan, and he was a machine gunner. And we went out to grab him, and his face was covered with dust, and he looked when a black guy dies. He gets a chalky looking, you know, on his face. So we went to grab him, and he opened up his eyes. He was alive. He wasn't even wounded. But and we grabbed him, and we pulled him, and they were shooting as we went and got back to the perimeter. And he was laughing and crying at the same time. And he told us a story. He played dead. And the gooks would come out, and they would stick a bayonet right by his head, and then they'd pick it up and they'd stick it on the other side of his head just to see if he was alive. And then he said the worst part is they took my canteen and they drank my water over the top of me, and I had to lay there, and he played dead, and they believed it. and so we went to grab him. He jumped up and scared the crap out of us because we thought he was dead, you know.
Wow.
And but that was a great time. Well, when we got back, the force started coming down, and they had flamethrowers. I shit you not, they had friggin' flamethrowers, and they started burning them hedges. So Gunny Burns told me that he carried a 12-gauge double-aught shotgun, and he blew the hell out of a flamethrower. One guy killed him. And so it was getting late in the day, and we were out of water. We were getting short on ammo, and Slater calls in air because they were coming. It was their big thrust. They were going to wipe us out. And so he called in air, and I was 10 feet from him when he was talking to the guy. And the guy said, "How close?" He goes, "Close." He goes, "How close is close?" He goes, "Close, God damn it, close." And he said, "Everybody get down." And they dropped that right on top of us, just outside of our perimeter. It was, the concussion was so enormous that I didn't have a hole. We couldn't dig a hole. We didn't have enough strength to dig in. They dropped that on top of us, and it lifted. I remember it lifted me off the ground, the concussion, about 4 feet, and slammed me back down on the ground. And that did it. That stopped the attack. So Slater knew what he was doing at that time. But the scariest thing in the world is have one of them fast movers coming right down your, and you see, oh my God, that's the scariest thing in the world. You see him up in the sky, and they're way far away, and they're scary. But this guy was right there and dropped that, and it was horrifying to see that. You could see the pilot. I mean, and that day, a lot of people don't realize this, but on July the 2nd, the enemy shot down two of our F-4s. One of them made it back to the Gulf of Tonkin and bailed out, and they got rescued. The other one just missed and went down, and it killed them both. And I got that information from an air controller who was in 2-9 on the ground. He's a good friend of mine. He lives not too far from me. And his name is Hawkmuth. I mean, not Hawkmuth, but Hollingsworth, General Hollingsworth. And he was a captain, and he knew those pilots. So that's how bad it was when they can shoot down jets.
Well, they had their surface air missiles just north of the DMZ, right? So when the NVA came south, right, they anticipated the fight, and the fight at some point, if you know, the Marines are going to bring in their air, and the way they're going to help their guys out is shoot those airplanes out of the sky, or at least keep them up really high. Wow, most of us can't even conceive of fighting like that because it's not, you know, it hasn't been done a whole lot. So talk about the day comes to a close, Ray, and you guys, you know, you start out, you know, doing a movement to contact, moving north. You know, Bravo Company blows up. You try to move. Alpha Company blows up. You guys essentially circle the wagons and try to save your company. And so the sun goes down that day. Where are you, and what are you doing?
Okay, here's what happened. It was late afternoon. It was fairly quiet by now because they were pouring everything on. We had artillery batteries firing. We had the ships firing. We had air. The ground was just shaking. That's where we lost our hearing, was with all that. And we could not, we were so spent, and it was so friggin' hot, and we didn't have water. I remember being on my knees, and I couldn't hardly move. And I had, here's something that I don't talk about a lot, but I had this fear of being out of water. If you've ever been thirsty before, and if you've ever gone to the point where your tongue starts swelling up, because, and you can't, your mouth sticks together, you start losing your mind after a while. You start seeing hallucinations, and because of the lack of water, and your insides start hurting. And I carried two or three canteens, three, I think. But I made a vow to myself that when my last canteen got down to half or less than half, I would not drink it. I'd rather die of thirst with water than not have water. You know what I mean? It was a mental thing for me. So it was one of those survival things that I guess, I don't know. So I had, and I wouldn't drink it. Well, it's kind of a good thing because we had a Sergeant Jones who turned chalky white. He was black, turned chalky white, and he had heat stroke so bad he couldn't move, and he was dying. And so I took my last bit of water and gave that to him, and that went against everything that I believe for self-preservation, but it was good that I had that because I was the only one I think that had water by then. And so just in that afternoon, we were all just almost laying around, and all of a sudden, a guy popped through the hedgerow, and it was a big guy named Ralph, I'll never forget him, from 3-9. And he goes, "Is this Alpha Company?" And Slater said, "Yes." He goes, "We got you covered, buddy. It's clear all the way to the trace. Come on." And so that's what happened. We grabbed our wounded. We picked up what we could, and we followed.
And that was the afternoon of the second.
Yes, that was it. That's how they finally broke off. I guess I don't know why, but they retreated after that. We killed a lot of them, so. We got our wounded, and then the worst part was we had to do – by then, see what happened at Conti Inn. Shenny knew what was going on, and he was trying to get – but he couldn't – Delta Company had the perimeter
right of
Conti Inn. Charlie Company was down at Fubai doing a rest or whatever, just right. – And they didn't even get their stuff unpacked when they got the order, "Get your ass back," you know. But Shenning couldn't – here, they wanted to take Conti Inn. Well, the only people that would defended Conti Inn was Delta Company. And so he couldn't really do much. But then when they broke off, that's when Radcliffe came – And Charlie Company finally got there, and they got the shit kicked out of them. Charlie Company came in, and boy, they, you know, I know all the stories from Charlie Company, you know, trying to rescue. But what they did is Shenning said, "I don't care, we take whoever you can off the hill, some Delta people, some." Charlie people, whatever, and go down there and try to help. And that's when Captain Radcliffe, who is a very good friend of mine, he came in, and he was going to take, I think he was going to take Bravo Company. So he went down and found a bunch of them came down off of Conti Inn, and they ran into Burns, Gunny Burns, and Radcliffe said, "Take me to your leader." And he goes, "I am. I'm 5, 6, 7. I am everyone." And he said, "Where's the rest of them?" And he said, "This is it." He said, "No, I'm talking about the rest of the company." He goes, "This is it." He said, "This is it." And there was like 27 guys walked out. And so they helped push back. This was before we got rescued, before 3-9 came in and said, "Come back." While that was going on, Radcliffe came down with a group of guys, and Charlie Company got there, and that helped push them away. We didn't know what was going on by then, you know, but then we got up and we made it back to the trace, but Slater wouldn't let us go back to Conti Inn. He said, "We're staying right here." So that night, and I remember this so clear, that night we dug in and I saw a SAM missile come from the north. It looked like a flying telephone pole, and I saw it chasing one of our jets. This was at night. And I was telling the guy, I said, look at that. What is that? And the guy told me, well, that's a SAM missile. And that thing chased that plane and chased that plane and chased that plane. And my recollection is that that plane got behind it and shot it and knocked it out of the sky. Slater thinks that he told me, he said, you remember that SAM missile? And I said, yeah. And he said, yeah, I got one of our planes. Well, he thinks it got one of our planes. I think that the plane circled around and shot it. That was my point of view. But we were totally spent, totally spent. We had nothing left in us.
So you guys go back to Contien, and then what? Right?
We didn't go back to Contien. We stayed right there. And 3-9 was there, 3-3 came in, 1-3 came in, 2-9 came in, and made a big area. But the 90th NVA Regiment, which I've heard this story so many times the 90th was one of their main goals was to wipe out 1-9. They hated 1-9. They knew who we were. We caused a lot of casualties with them. And General Jopp, who was the general over the massacre at Bien Bien Phu, he masterminded that. Well, he was still General Jopp masterminding the theater and the operations under Ho Chi Minh when we were there in Vietnam. And he respected us, but he told Ho Chi Minh that he would eventually wipe out 1-9. That was one of his goals.
It's an amazing story. In the sun comes up, so 3-9 shows up, they make contact with you, they tell you, right, the path is open to get back to Contien, but you don't go back to Contien that night. So talk about the days afterward, the days after July 2nd. But we're not going to go to the 6th yet. All right. We're going to save that for next time. So as this, you know, operation Buffalo, winds down or continues, what happened next?
Well, when we got back to the Trace, which is the McNamara line or whatever they call it, by then we got in the center. We went in the center and they put company all around us so that we could just sleep. And we dug in the best we could. And I remember being fairly close to the jungle. We were on the Trace, but we were, you know, the jungle was prevalent, you know. But they gave us like a perimeter, and they guarded us. I think before that, we went down and some of us went and tried to pull out bodies from Bravo Company. And I remember them bringing, you know, the poncho light. We didn't have litters or we didn't have body bags. We had ponchos. And the ponchos served as protection. It was our, you know, like our tents. And it was our body bags. We used them. So we pulled those guys out. And that just, I can't talk about that.
Right. All right. And that was on July 3rd?
Yeah.
July 3rd, yeah. 4th. Yeah. And so take us to from July 3rd to July 4th and July 5th, and then we'll stop there, because there's a different fight that happens that we'll do in the next episode. So what happens over the next couple of days?
Well, I was suffering. I got one of those mortars that hit close to my hole when I was with Steve and Horace. one of those hit so close it I was knocked out for a short period, and I believe I had a concussion. But they didn't treat concussion. If you weren't bleeding,
right.
you stayed there.
Right.
So the time I got back with that, and I remember so clearly everything up to that point. And then when I got back and we just had, time, I do not remember anything from, I remember the third, the next day. I don't remember. Then the fourth, I remember that SAM missile thing, because I was thinking this is the 4th of July. And then I don't remember the 5th at all. And I don't remember most of the 4th. I just don't remember it. I just know that we weren't doing anything. And if you don't do anything, there's no memory that's available.
What haven't I asked you about Operation Buffalo that you think is important that people know, other than we'll get to the 6 next time, but what haven't I asked you about the events of July 2nd, 1967 that's important and you want people to know?
I guess I've never seen any more heroic things happen. And the Marine Corps is really bad about giving medals. And even the Marine Corps will tell you that.
Oh, God almighty, but it's horrible.
They're horrible. And they're so afraid. The Army gives out medals like, candy. And the Marine Corps doesn't want to be like the Army. So, I think the pride, if I was ever, and I've been through operation after operation after operation, I've seen guys give their lives. But that day of survival, totally spent, and they were still fighting. I can't believe we did that. I just can't believe that. But the biggest thing I think they say is trust your training. And I don't care if you're a private, you're a PFC. I was a squad leader as a Lance Corporal, and they had to give me Lance Corporal so I could be a squad leader because of process elimination. But trust your training. And all the discipline that we went through and the hell we went through with boot camp and all the training we did, it made that July the 2nd possible.
For the guys that lived. Without that kind of training and without that kind of sticking
together. Without that, I mean, that drill instructor in your face, and I mean 2 inches from your face, screaming at your face, and those times when they thumped you, back then they could, they beat the hell out of you or whatever, and it made you mad, and the things that you did, and it stirred you up, because war is different, combat is different than peacetime, but we're all, even peacetime veterans, they got the same training. And I tell this to the guys. They say, well, I wasn't in a battle. I said, well, you would have been. You were trained for it. And I was so proud of all the guys I served with and all that running up Mount MF in Porno and all those times of we hated those trainers and the discipline and all that, and we didn't understand it. But they did, and I tell people this, if it wasn't for our World War II vets and our Korean Marines who had been through Tarawa, been through Iwo Jima, and been through Guadalcanal. Those were our leaders. And if it hadn't been for them, we probably wouldn't have made it. But what made us was the training, the discipline and the training. And that discipline still is with me today. And once a Marine, always a Marine.
My guest for the last hour or so has been Ray Limbaugh. He's a member of he's a Vietnam veteran, a Marine, and a proud veteran of Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. I asked everybody from 1-9 how they feel about the nickname The Walking Dead. Some guys aren't real fond of it. Some guys say, well, you know, it's grown on me. I used to hate it. And but now, you know, it's kind of, you know, when we were there and people started calling us that, we didn't particularly care for it. But now it's, you know, it's kind of who we are and it's our identity. And so we don't mind it as much anymore. What are your thoughts on it, Ray?
Well, I didn't really know that name when I was in Vietnam. I learned about that after I got stateside. And I didn't know we were famous because I just didn't talk about it for 30 years or whatever. And I went to a PTSD unit in 2002, and guy looked it up and said, you know, you all are famous. And I said, The Walking Dead. And I knew that we were The Walking Dead. And he said, you know, you're famous. And I said, what do you mean? And he got me in contact with the website, and I looked at it and I thought, holy mackerel, I had no idea that it was that, you know, we didn't mean to be famous or we didn't mean to be The Walking Dead. It wasn't like that's, we wore that badge over there. We didn't. We were just Marines and doing our job, doing what we were supposed to do. But the pride of it and the honor to be a member of The Walking Dead is something that eventually grows on you and it eventually takes root, and you realize that. I've run into a lot of young Marines through the years, and they say, oh, yeah, we had to learn your history. I said, are you kidding me? And he goes, no, we had to learn your history. And so it didn't sink in. It took a long time for that to actually sink in, that there's something to that, you know. But I know Captain Contact, that was his nickname. he asked me one time, he said, I got to ask you a question. I said, what? He says, what do you think that Captain Con, is that a bad thing, or is that? I said, no, that was a badge of distinction. That was, well, it probably wasn't.
Yeah, but he doesn't need to know that, right?
He could make that was our job, is to make contact with the enemy.
Right.
It was kind of a raider type battalion. That, yeah, that's what our job was. And he could do that. So I just told him it was an. I said, no, that's a term of endearment. So we're proud of you.
There you go. So. There you go. The all right, Ray. First of all, I like a lot of Marines. I Contien is not as well known as it should be. The fighting that went on there.
No,
you hear about Khe Sanh. Right, you hear about Hue City and the battles during the Tet Offensive, but I would tell you, to me, it's a pretty big eye opener when you begin to, you know, to look into the battles between the Marines of the 3rd Marine Division and the North Vietnamese Army in the northern part of I Corps in Leatherneck Square, and if you want to talk about an enemy that would close with you, that would bring flamethrowers to burn you out of hedgerows after they ambushed you so they could kill you. That was them. That was the fight that went on there. And I just want to thank you for, you know, sharing your experience as a member of Operation Buffalo on one of the on the most costly day for any one unit in Vietnam on July 2nd, 1967, and just So give everybody a tease what the next episode when we talk about July 6th. The story gets better, yes?
Oh, listen, I was down the 4th and the 5th. I don't remember the 4th and 5th at all. But we got the order on the 6th of July to go back in with the recon unit and check things out. And the story, I won't say anything more about that, but we kicked their ass big time. We were victorious. July the 6th is probably one of the best days and the worst days of my life. The second was the worst. At the same time, it was the best because we survived. But the 6th of July, it is, I remember almost every moment of that because that was a day of victory that I'll never forget. And I can't wait to share that victorious day.
All right, and so we'll do that in our next installment. So, again, thank you so much for doing this, Ray, and thank your daughter for getting you on Skype. So everything sounds good, and as I said, you know, you can go look at the maps. You can, if you start at the top, map one is the general area of Leatherneck Square and the northern part of I-Corps. Map two is the base of Contien, and they're all labeled. Map three is a pretty detailed schematic of the events of July 2nd, 1967. You'll see where Alpha Company started, and you know, you can see that, you know, trying to get the Bravo Company with a whole lot of NVA soldiers there waiting for them. You can see what a challenge that was. You can see where the trace is and everything that we've talked about. So there's a whole series of maps. Map four is out of one of the Marine publications that talks about Operation Buffalo. Map number five shows where 3-9 showed up and where 1-3 showed up. So you can see elements of that. And then map six, and this is a little bit of a tease, is a schematic of events 6 to 7 July of 1967. And Ray just said they kicked their ass, and you can actually see where Ray's fighting position is. I put a label on the map to show you where Ray's fighting hole is. So we'll do that. We'll do that a week from today. So, Ray, again, thank you so much for doing this. These battlefield studies, Marines listen to them, and I think it mentally prepares them, you know, for, you know, if you say you're going to fight the Russians and the Chinese, right, you better have it strapped on because they're not going to quit. Just like, you know, when the part of the story is, you know, yeah, 1-9 got punched straight in the face. With a devastating blow, but they had to continue to fight, right? Alpha Company has to continue to fight. The guys who survived in Bravo Company had to continue to fight for their lives and then ultimately reconstitute their company. So it doesn't end just because you got kicked in the face. The requirement is that you hang in there and you go. And so thank you, Ray, very much.
My pleasure. Remember, trust your training. It works.
All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.